Hello, everybody. You are listening to Limited Playtime, the board game podcast where we bring you board game reviews in 30 minutes or less.
Or the next episode is free.
I'm Kyle Bolin.
And I'm Jason Cavallari.
And this is NPR.
You caught me off guard with that.
We can restart.
It's fine. I kind of liked it.
Hello, everybody. You are listening to Limited Playtime, the board game podcast where we bring you board game reviews in 30 minutes or less.
Or the next episode is free.
I am Kyle Bolin.
And I'm Jason Cavallari.
And today we are talking about the castles of Mad King Ludwig.
He's mad, I tell you.
So I'm pretty sure the theme of this game is that a king decided to travel to Antarctica to investigate strange goings on. And then decided to build a castle there, and the Mountains of Madness, Cthulhu, Madness,
right.
Mad King Ludwig, crazy castle. Is that it, Jason? Is that what's on the inside of the box lid or something?
Not quite. The backstory would probably be a lot more interesting, but no, it's about King Ludwig of Bavaria, who was called Mad because he spent a lot of money building a ton of different castles, most of which are very, very famous for their sort of fantastical aesthetic. But he probably wasn't actually insane, just really creative and eccentric.
We've talked about this. I actually knew all that. But anyway, this game on Board Game Geek is rated between 1 and 4 players. It is given a 90-minute playing time, and it has a weight of 2.65. It is designed by Ted Alsbach. Art is by Keith Curtis. Here we go. Agnieszka Dabrowicka? Dabrowicka? And Alan Tim, and it is published by Bezier Games, who we've talked about on this podcast before, because they published Whistle Stop. Have we done any of their other games?
I don't know. I
can't remember if we did or not, but we definitely did Whistle Stop, and they definitely published that. So
yeah,
this is a publisher that we are at least semi-familiar with. They also have another game that I believe uses some similar mechanics to this called Suburbia, which some people see as the sort of Sim City of board games.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That actually makes me think that I would like it.
I have played the digital version of it, and I kind of want to play it for real. So we should
maybe look into that. Now I'm intrigued. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway,
Castles of Mad King Ludwig. Yeah. Castles of Mad King Ludwig from 2014. We have played, you own the game, correct, Jason?
I do.
So you can speak to its component quality and all of that. I have played a digital reimplementation of it. Well, it's not really. It's the tabletop simulator version, right? We've played that twice now. I've played it with you twice now. So I can speak to the mechanics of it and sort of the artwork, at least as recreated in Tabletop Simulator. But why don't you go into the explanation of what kind of a game this is, if you were going to give somebody the elevator pitch about what kind of game Castles of Mad King Ludwig is, not Mud King.
Mudwig. Mud King Mudwig.
The Mud King Ludwig. How would you describe the game, Jason?
Okay, so it's kind of like
Tetris.
It's a tile laying game, basically. So it's kind of like Carcassonne or Alhambra, if you've ever played that. But it's a little bit more complicated because in each of those games, the tiles are squares. You know, they're four-sided things, and you lay them next to each other, and they all fit nicely together. In Castles of Mad King Ludwig, the tiles are all different kinds of shapes. They're big circles and little circles, squares of all different sizes, and rectangles and L shapes and whatever have you.
There's a stretched out octagon.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, put that in your octagon. Pipe and smoke it.
So putting a castle together based with these, made of these tiles is not, you know, just laying tiles next to each other. You have to be a little bit more proactive in where you place things because, you know, if you can't fit it on there without making it overlap something else, then you can't use it. I myself have fallen prey to that many times, having bought a room that I thought would be awesome in one particular place just to find out that it doesn't fit. So that's sort of the you know, nuts and bolts kind of thing. Now, the point system, which is how you win the game, you have to end with the most points. is based on
Shocker.
is based on the different rooms that you place in the castle and how you place them. So you get both a score for the room that you place itself. It just has a flat score value. And then in the middle of the room, there's usually an indicator that tells you if you have to or if you can add or subtract points based on the rooms that it's placed next to. So, for example, activity rooms, which are, in the mythology of the game, like they're supposed to be like loud. So if you put them next to like a bedroom or something, you're going to lose points because you placed it in an inauspicious place.
Nobody wants to hear somebody playing a chubby guitar next door when they're trying to go to sleep.
Yeah. Otherwise known as a lute. So or, you know, if you place things that are next to each other, that can be beneficial. So if you place like the pantry next to the kitchen, you would probably get extra points for that or something, you know. So so it works both ways. That's the main scoring mechanic. And then there are other things. So like at the end of the game, there's a few different, I think they're called like favor tiles. They're set out at the beginning of the game and they tell you, you know, at the end of the game, whoever has the most square shaped rooms gets 8 points. And the second player with the most square shaped rooms gets 4 points and so on. So there's a few of those. You also get bonus like secret objectives that are dealt to you at the beginning of the game. And sometimes you get extra ones as the game goes on. Which can also score you additional points. You get points for any leftover money you had at the end of the game. And and sometimes completion bonuses. If you complete a room by attaching every entrance and exit of that room to another tile, then you get a completion bonus. And they do all kinds of different things. Some of them are straight up victory points. Some of them give you money. Some of them let you take another turn. You know, they're just kind of all over the place.
Yeah, it's like a complete, there's like one for each type of room, of which there's 8. So there'd be like,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's basically how it works. You do that until the room deck, which is what, you know, the room deck kind of decides which tiles are placed in the market. And you keep playing until that deck is exhausted. Now, the real interesting thing for me, besides the fact that the tiles are just all different kinds of shapes, is the market mechanic, which is how it's basically like the level of interaction that you have between players. Whoever is designated the master builder for that round, it's like the first player token or whatever. They actually get to take the room tiles that are on sale that round and arrange them and assign them prices before any buying takes place. So you could say, look at the available selections and say, oh, this room is actually probably really desirable for somebody because, you know, if they put it in their castle, they would probably score a bunch of points. So I'm going to make that one the most expensive thing on the block. So either they end up paying a lot of money for it, which goes to me because as the master builder, or they miss out on a lot of points because they don't want to spend the money or they don't have it or whatever. And you can sort of, play with that kind of mechanic to either screw each other over or, you know, maybe scratch each other's back, or it's kind of a flexible kind of mechanic. That's basically it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've played this more than I have, right?
Yeah, a few times.
Yeah, a few times more. Yeah. It's a game that, like the castles itself, is sort of mad in the way that it takes many mechanics that are like present in other board games and kind of combines them together, you know? Like there's the whole like you choose sort of mechanic with where you place all the different tiles that are available per round and kind of pricing them so that, you know, the other person is going to have opportunities to like buy something before you do, because as the master builder, you're the last person to purchase a tile that round, right? The round that you set it up and everything. So you're giving those other people like opportunities to purchase those things, and they might purchase them before you do, the things that you want to get, but they're going to do so, hopefully, if you set it upright, like at a higher cost than what they would prefer. It's got that going on. It's got like the whole sort of Tetris element of trying to make sure that you fit all these crazy shaped rooms together with, and even within within a room shape, right? Like, not every stretchy octagon room is going to have doors in the same exact spots as the next one, right? And right. So you've got to think about where the door placement is also when you're looking at the rooms that you want to buy and thinking about where you can fit it into the castle that you've got, the pre-existing floor plan and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at that, looking at the Tetris piece of it, looking at the sort of set collection bonus stuff going on where you're trying to have maybe like a bunch of, you might have like a bunch of fireplace rooms or whatever they are. I don't know, like the lounge rooms or whatever they're supposed to be.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, the purple rooms.
Yeah. I think that the game will often reward you for having adjacency with those particular rooms, you know, and you, so you, there's like a certain element of set collection or, you know, matching going on there where you're trying to match certain rooms to be adjacent to other rooms to really capitalize on those adjacency bonuses that it's giving you, as well as trying to close up all the doors so that you get the, you know, the special bonus that it reminds me of something like, I don't know, like when I was trying to think about how, what it reminds me of playing it, the first thing that came to mind for some reason was Castles of Burgundy.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, where it's just like there's, you might miss out on an opportunity to get a particular tile that you want in Castles of Burgundy, but you might get the thing that you really need, and then it sets off this sort of chain reaction of bonuses that is extremely satisfying to get, right?
Yeah.
That can happen in this game where you get just the right room next to just the right other room. It also happens to be the final room that you need in order to close that first room up. You get the points listed on the room itself, plus you get the adjacency bonus from one or two of those rooms, your point counter can just jump right up the track, and then in addition to that, you end the round with an additional bonus that comes from whatever the type of room bonus was, which could end up being another turn, which could end up causing another cascade of those effects to happen, right?
Yeah. Right? There's a lot of another piece and so on, yeah.
There's a lot of potential for just a lot of chain reaction, satisfying sort of moves and turns to happen in this game, and that's really fun.
Yeah, when it works out, it's really great. The hard part is, I think, as
lining it all up, right?
Like getting it all to line up.
Yeah,
because you're technically not allowed to like try out a piece before you put it, you know, before you purchase it.
Yeah, and I think that you and I have both we've both made mistakes when trying to eyeball a piece and to determine whether or not that's going to fit exactly where we need it to fit in our existing castle.
Right.
And then you get over there and you're like, oh crap.
Yeah.
What am I going to do with this junk now? And that's, it feels like the junk in Tetris, right? It feels like all of a sudden you're just throwing this somewhere, maybe getting a couple points out of it just on the face value of the room, but it doesn't have any synergy with the room you're placing it next to, and you just feel like an idiot in that moment, right?
Yeah. I mean, chances are you can put it somewhere, but it's probably not going to be as beneficial as where you had planned to place it.
Yeah, and the game gives you certain the game has certain mechanics built into it to sort of mitigate those situations. At least you could make your castle in a way where it would be almost impossible to not have some spot to put something. Like if you put a hallway down, there are so many doors coming off of those hallways, and they're so long and thin that if you just like, you know, put that off in another direction, just some direction away from all your other rooms, it's almost like an insurance policy to make sure that you've got somewhere to dump things if you wind up in that situation where they just don't fit with the rooms that you really care about so far.
Yeah. Hallways aren't worth a whole lot of points though, which is sort of the downside. So you have to pay like, I don't know, 3,000 whatever coins.
And isn't the bonus for completing a hallway putting down another hallway?
Putting down a free hallway.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. I know. I mean, completing a hallway in the first place would be pretty difficult.
Yeah. There's a lot of doors on them.
Yeah. The thing that I do like about that is that about the mechanic where like you're not allowed to try it out and you kind of have to guess. Is that if you end up in a situation where you purchase a room that you literally cannot place anywhere, you are allowed to put it back. Like you're not allowed to purchase it if you can't place it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now if you buy something and you can't place it where you want to place it, but you can place it somewhere else, that you don't get to return on that. But if you literally buy one that you have absolutely no use for, you technically can't buy it in the first place.
So then I guess you don't need the insurance policy hallway at all. I didn't know that rule existed. So,
well, I mean, it's kind of a good thing to have anyway, because it just kind of ensures that because trying to build these things in a really kind of close space is not going to work for very long.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. This game, it looks pretty good to me. I wasn't expecting that, actually, when we played the, like, normal version of the game. I was expecting it to be somewhat drab or something. I think because they just ran a Kickstarter not too long ago for a special collector's edition of it, and one of the things that they were advertising for that Kickstarter was new artwork for the tiles. And when they did that, the same thing for Suburbia, one of the reasons was because the original version of Suburbia had really boring looking tiles.
Oh. but I've always liked the tiles in King Ludwig.
They look good. They are vibrant and colorful and evocative of, like, I don't know if I want to say cheerful castle, but I mean it's a very colorful, sort of playfulish looking castle, I think.
They kind of remind me of the artwork on, like, the old upscale editions of, like, Clue, you know?
Yeah. That's a good way to think about it. Yeah, once you get your castle down and you've got all these different shaped rooms that all have, well, I guess, like, you know, eight different colors, right? It does kind of resemble, like, a really vibrant-looking Clue. Like, you're talking about, like, if you had, like, the Simpsons Clue edition or something like that, right?
Yeah, or even just the normal Clue, but it had, like, the, you know, they did, like, a glow-up of it in the 90s and you know, the artwork was sort of cartoony, but it also, like, looks really cool and kind of.
I don't think I've seen this. See, we grew up with the 80s version, and the I think they call it, like, what, classic or vintage now or something like that.
Oh, God, really?
There's a name for that particular edition of Clue that I grew up with. It's like the 1985 edition or something like that. And it was pretty brown. A lot of brown.
The thing is that my parents had this old version from, like, the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
And all this, like, crazy art in it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know the one you're talking about, but I've seen, you know, everybody's seen the Monopoly editions of, you know, there's a billion types of Monopoly out there. And I've seen similar clues out there where it's, like, different themed clue boards. And they definitely have more color in them than the one I grew up with. And yeah, I mean, it resembles that, you know, like a colorful, crazy collection of hallways and rooms of various, you know, shapes and colors. So
yeah,
fun to look at.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, owning the game in person, you know, I've handled the pieces quite
yes,
quite often. I've handled the pieces. Mm-hmm. And they're good. I mean, it's not like cheap cardboard, which you might expect in a lot of games that are sort of, you know, tiling games.
It's not the half millimeter cardboard we had from the 80s and, like, our HeroQuest game and stuff.
Yeah, no, it's not like that. It's good solid stuff, you know. It doesn't really warp. And it has a good heft to it. The artwork shows up really well on it. It comes with this sort of, like, massive organizational board, which is where you put all the tiles and stuff before they go into the market, and the, like, with the score track. And when you put it together, it actually looks like a big tower.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's flat. It doesn't stand up by itself, but there's, like, an outline of a tower on the table.
I'm looking at what I believe is an organizer on Board Game Geek, and I don't understand why they would need to, like, one of the things that they did with the special edition was create, like, a much more robust sort of organizer to, like, put out and for people to grab tiles from and everything. That plus, I think, bigger, thicker tiles with new artwork. And just looking at this, I just keep wondering, like, why?
Yeah, like, why would you need? I don't know. The system worked fine.
Yeah. And the thing,
like, I looked at that Kickstarter, and I really like this game a lot. So yeah, you know, it's something that I was like, oh, a really nice fancy edition of this could be good. And I ultimately decided against it just because I was, you know, the game itself is fine the way it is.
Well, and how much? It was like $100, right?
Yeah.
This is not $100 game.
No. So, I mean, you're basically paying for the upgraded components.
Well, that's what you're paying for, but it's not a game that really, I don't feel like it's a game that benefits from components that upgraded. There's a certain type of game where you get sucked into the theme of it, and having little plastic minis or plastic miniature furniture or whatever kind of helps you get soaked into the theme, right? It helps you really buy into the fantasy that you are on board for, right? Like a HeroQuest, or, you know, like what we were talking about, how AlterQuest is a more recent game that did the same thing that HeroQuest did with, like, you know, 3D furniture and all that. And that kind of helps with the fantasy of being in this fantasy world and everything that you are a character in. I think that helps. I think that there's certain other components that can really be upgraded and it's nice, like, you know, a nice heavy chip for keeping track of money or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's something that can be really worthwhile. But this game is just about, you know, lining these things up in like, it's a spatial puzzle. It's mm-hmm. a adjacency puzzle, right? It's like sort of like a set collection puzzle. And I don't feel like upgraded components necessarily improve any of the things that it does.
Yeah, no, I mean, it certainly wouldn't have a huge impact on any of the mechanics or anything like that. It would just look prettier.
Yeah, and I'm sure
it already
looks
pretty
good. It
looks
good. Great. It looks good enough.
So 1 year for my birthday, my husband got me like a really, really nice edition of Ticket to Ride. And I love it. I mean, it's gorgeous and it looks great and it's a really nice thing to have, but it doesn't change the game any. It just sort of makes it a little more, you know, fun to look at.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody bought you that $100 edition of Castles of Mighty King Ludwig, you wouldn't necessarily like turn it away or anything, you know?
No,
like,
of course not. That'd be a great gift.
It's awesome, yeah. But if you're looking to get a decent Euro game that uses these sorts of mechanics and it provides this sort of an experience, we would not recommend going and paying $100 for it when you can get it from, you know, like a normal board game store for $60 or less.
Yeah, yeah. I got mine on sale, I think, from Barnes & Noble.
Yeah. I mean, like, this feels like the kind of game, like Castles of Burgundy, that you're going to go to the store and you're going to come home with it for $40 or $50 or something. And it's, you know, like, you're going to have a great time with it, you know?
Yeah.
It is a fun game.
It is. And it's fast to teach.
Yep. Yeah, it was not hard to learn. Plays 90 minutes is accurate. We played almost exactly to 90 minutes in our 3-player game a few days ago. So, you know, you can expect that, I think, out of probably a 3 or 4 player game. I don't know how quickly it would play at 2. It says that you can play it at 1. Do you know if it's just one of those sort of solitaire rules where it's like, hey, play to a high score. You're looking, if you score this much, you know, you're good. If you score this much, you're even better. Is it one of those, or is there an actual solitaire deck in here?
You know what? I have no idea. I've never looked into playing it solo. Okay. I don't think it's a game that I would want to play solo.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it does seem silly because a major part of the game is the sort of, like, you know, rearranging the cost of the room tiles so that you're screwing over your friends.
Right. Which is the point of any board game.
Or you know, like preemptively taking advantage of them. You know that they need this tile and you're going to make them pay you for it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So playing this solo would completely undermine that entire portion of the game, which is, I think, a pretty sizable portion of the game. I don't think that you can omit that component of it and still have the same exact game, right?
Right, yeah. I kind of also like seeing what other people build with their tiles. Like, it's...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, I can look at what I built, and that's fine. But, yeah, so, yeah. I mean, the, you know, playing solo just has no appeal for me, even if there are actual genuine, like, solo rules.
Yeah, well, I'd be interested to see what they are, if there are thoughtful solo rules, because I do a lot of solo gaming. But from what I've seen, if it's just the typical Euro solo, you know, sort of, I think of like Agricola type rules, where it's just like, just play the game like normal, because it's pretty much solitaire anyway, and then see how high of a score you get. If it's that, then I'm not as interested in playing it solo. But yeah. So anyway, seems like we're pretty positive on this game, right?
Yeah, I really like this game.
Maybe we'll find out if it shows up on anybody's top 10, because we're talking about maybe revising our top 10 sometime in the near future, since it's been a while since we did that. But until then, we have other games that we're going to talk about. I just started going into this. Is there anything else you want to talk about in regards to the Castles of Mad King Ludwig?
Oh, no, not really. I mean, I just very quickly looked up what the solo play is like. And,
yeah.
So this website says the difference in the solo play version is that you flip over room cards and they go in order from 2,000, 4,000, and 6,000 spots. You choose one to use or buy stairs or pass, and the rooms that didn't get used then get discarded.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
yeah,
in about 2 weeks, we are going to be back with another episode, and we are going to be talking about PAX Pamir 2nd Edition, which came out, I think, a year ago or so. Maybe. No, I got my copy a year ago, but it's been out for a couple years now. That is another sort of war-ish game from Cole Whirl. Was it Whirl or Whirly? Do you know?
Whirly?
Whirly? I think it's Whirly. Yeah, because they do Whirly Gig games, right?
Yeah, so yeah,
Whirly.
Yeah, yeah.
Cole Whirly.
Yeah.
See, he's designed other games you may have heard of, some of them, such as Root. So that is what we're going to be talking about in 2.5 weeks. Jason, if people would like to get a hold of us and tell us what the most interesting fact they know about the war in Afghanistan in the 19th century is, how would they do so?
All right. Well, to give us all your knowledge of the great game in Central Asia, you can email us. It's podcast@limitedplaytime.com. You can go to the website, limitedplaytime.com. You can tweet us at Limited Playtime or go to Instagram at Limited Playtime Podcast.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Later.
Bye.